Deep in the ocean, an orca pod is on the hunt. But these aren't your average orcas. These guys are organized.
Marketing team, did you get those social media posts scheduled for the seal migration?
Aye, aye, Captain. We even have an automated notification for all pod managers when they go live.
They use Monday.com to keep their teamwork sharp, their communication clear, and their goals in sight. Monday.com, for whatever you run, even orcas. Go to Monday.com to dive deeper.
What's new from Apple? There's the new iPhone 16 Pro, built for Apple Intelligence. And it comes with the all-new camera control, giving you an easier way to quickly access your camera tools. The new Apple Watch Series 10 has our biggest display and our thinnest design ever. And this? It's the sound of active noise cancellation, now available on one of two new AirPods 4 models. So quiet. Check out all of the new products and new features at Apple.com. You can even buy yourself something new. See Apple.com for product availability updates. Apple Intelligence coming this fall.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive, America's number one motorcycle insurer. Everything is more exhilarating when you're on your motorcycle, just like your bike is more protected when you choose Progressive Motorcycle Insurance. They offer coverage for your bike starting as low as $75 per year, and they keep things affordable with discounts like paid in full, multi-policy, and responsible driver. So raise your kickstands and get to quoting at Progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. $75 premium is for state minimum coverage. Not available in DC. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today to be speaking with Dr. Stephanie Canizales about her book titled Sin Padres Ni Papeles, Unaccompanied Migrant Youth Coming of Age in the United States, published by the University of California Press in 2024, documenting the fact that thousands of youth every year endure really quite intense circumstances to end up in the United States unaccompanied and without papers, very much in pursuit of a better future. What is welcoming, or what is the state in which these young people end up in the United States? What do they find once they've crossed the borders? It's not exactly the simplest situation, and it's quite a challenging one to navigate while also coming of age, as any youth does. And that's exactly the situation that this book investigates in a lot of very helpful detail. So, Stephanie, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast to tell us about your book.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to have you. And I think probably a good place to start is, could you introduce yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, I am Stephanie Canizales, assistant professor of sociology at UC Berkeley. I am the faculty director of the Berkeley Interdisciplinary Migration Initiative and the author of Sin Padres Ni Papeles. As you mentioned, it is the migration, incorporation, and coming of age story of unaccompanied and undocumented Central American and Mexican youth in the U.S. I'm born and raised in Los Angeles. I am an LA girl through and through. I did my undergrad and graduate education in Los Angeles and came to this work through organizing and advocacy with undocumented students. It is sort of, in 2010, 2011, 2012, when I was coming into this research, we were at the peak of sort of the Dreamer movement, the DACA movement, and the transition into organizing around Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, DACA, thinking about immigrant youth, undocumented immigrant youth who were deserving, are deserving of legal protection and full recognition in U.S. society. I came to the work on unaccompanied, undocumented youth that are profiled in this book sort of serendipitously. I meant to study undocumented youth organizing and the emotional and social effects of being involved in youth groups, and was invited to join a group of undocumented youth in the Pico Union area, the neighborhood in Los Angeles closest to downtown Los Angeles, which is known as the Central American Community Corridor, the sort of concentrated area in LA where Central American immigrants first arrive and claim space. This work you know, it came at me sort of by surprise in 2012. I encountered a group of unaccompanied, undocumented youth workers. And it was the complete opposite sort of coming of age and life story that I'd come to know through my work organizing and advocating for undocumented students in Los Angeles at the time. So I, you know, spent the next 6 years really trying to understand what it meant to be unaccompanied and undocumented. And by virtue of those two features, right, not having a parent or a caregiver in the U.S. to do the sacrificial work of laboring for a child, finding housing, learning a new city so that the kid can go to school and experience a sort of normative expected childhood. Kids have to do that on their own, right? And as you mentioned in the introduction, it is not only an immigrant entering a new society, sort of learning the ropes and trying to survive, but it is a young person that is entering into a life stage of identity development, self-discovery. Their bodies are changing. Their relationships to themselves and the people around them and their society at large are really in formation. So these simultaneous incorporation and coming of age journeys as co-occurring and as processes that young people struggle through as unaccompanied and undocumented immigrants, but also find strength and courage and relationships that pull them through those processes as they come of age.
Thank you for giving us that background and kind of illuminating some of the areas I think we're going to discuss in more detail. I wonder if we can talk a bit about kind of how putting these ideas together, you know, thinking about immigration, but also, as you said, the coming of age and understanding how they're so entangled for these youths in particular. How is this reconceptualizing our understanding of immigrant incorporation?
Yeah, so I came into this project with very concrete sort of indicators of what incorporation would look like, right? You go into the field and you're trying to suss out what's going on, right? And something I struggled with was that when I was entering the field again in 2012, when I started this work as a graduate student, I was really new to sociology. And I'd come to know incorporation theory, you know, part of the sort of lineage or genealogy of like an assimilation theory, right? This idea that you shed your culture, immigrants shed their culture in preference for the host society's culture, right? And there's some debates about the racist sort of colonial notions that are embedded in the assimilation theory framework. And preference given men to incorporation or integration theory that really looks at structures, relationships, what are the policies, the economic conditions, and the community conditions that make certain outcomes so. What I was noticing when I entered this project is that the young people that I was spending time with, they weren't attaining those outcomes, those markers, right? And again, I came to this work through my advocacy with undocumented students, and we were advocating in those spaces for the recognition of the attainment of high levels of education, right? High aspirations for mobility, all these markers of Americanness besides the paper that grants legal status. So when I came to the work on unaccompanied and undocumented youth, I'm talking about young kids who had never enrolled in a K-12 school, right? Didn't have any sort of certificate of perfect attendance or a report card to point to their sort of normative or ideal productivity as a young person. They were not thinking about attaining any sort of degree, right, in the way that we had come to know through the Dreamer movement. So what I became attuned to was that the outcomes of incorporation, the educational attainment, the job placement, job mobility, wealth accumulation, or even language acquisition and English language proficiency were not going to be the markers that these young people would be able to attain, not because they didn't want them or didn't value them, But because their life circumstances as unaccompanied young people made it so that they needed to enter a completely different pathway in society, a different corner of the world, they would be low-wage workers in factories, car washes, domestic workers. So even if they valued education, they would not be in a position where they could go to high school, then enroll in college. And so I really wanted to pay attention to how these sort of idealized outcomes were not attainable as desirable as they might have been. And thinking about how incorporation and sort of life course theory play together, there are also outcomes that we associate with a successful transition to adulthood, right? Leaving a parent's home, finishing education, starting a job, starting a family, having your own children, these sort of markers that indicate a successful transition into adulthood. And again, we were talking about unaccompanied young people who left their homes when they were 8, 9, 10 years old, right? So is that adulthood? They began working when they were 3 years old in their origin countries. Is that adulthood? So really playing with what does it mean to embody an experience of incorporation or a transition to adulthood without attaining the outcome or the sort of static marker of success in each of those spheres of life.
Yeah, this is such a key part of the book. And I think we're going to kind of keep talking about it as we go through this idea of sort of what adulthood means and what options are or are not available or imagined to be available or not. But before we get into some of that, I wonder if you can tell us a bit more about how you conducted this research and maybe any advice you might have for other researchers looking to use the same sorts of methods you have.
Yeah, I came to the work as a qualitative researcher. Again, I was new to sociology. I was new to research. I'm a first generation college student, academic, first to do any of these things in sort of my social sphere. So what I knew really well was talking to people. And I remember a professor of mine in, you know, early graduate school days said that sociology is really chismología, which chisme in Spanish is gossip or, you know, talking. So it's the study of talking and the sharing of information through essentially gossiping, right? So I thought, like, I could talk to people, and I'm really curious about the narratives, the stories people tell about their lives. So I entered the field as an ethnographer. The group that I mentioned earlier, someone mentioned to me, there's a group of undocumented youth that meet on Friday nights from 7 to 9 p.m. on this at a Starbucks on this corner in Pico Union. And I went to that space thinking again that I would encounter maybe students or young people that were sort of organizing in the way that I had been accustomed to seeing. But they were a group of unaccompanied, undocumented, indigenous Guatemalan garment workers. A majority of them were garment workers. It was really disorienting to me to meet this group of young people, given what I had known and sort of come into research knowing about undocumented youth as students. So I spent about 7 months. At the time, my Spanish wasn't great. And I'm not an indigenous Central American. I'm the daughter of Central American immigrants. I know Pico Union well from having grown up in that space, but I hadn't experienced their version of Pico Union. So I both like was in proximity, but very much outside of the experience of that group. And it showed, my outsider status showed in that people wouldn't speak to me directly. It took about 7 months of me showing up. And there were times where I even told the group coordinators, like, I think I'm making people uncomfortable. I probably shouldn't come to this group anymore. And they told me, definitely keep coming. They'll warm up to you. Like, trust me. This is how it goes with these group of youth. So I kept showing up, and one day, finally, someone agreed to be interviewed by me, and it was a sort of cascading effect. I started interviewing young people in that support group, wrote a little bit about the group. I was then invited by young people to attend the youth groups at the church on Friday, Saturday, or nights, or Sunday mornings. Did that and sort of snowballed, not just snowballed the interviewing in that, you know, I took referrals, I interviewed the next unaccompanied undocumented young person, but also snowballing the sort of spaces that I would conduct my observations. And so I got invitations to have lunch and dinner with people, you know, sort of privately, or to attend reading groups, or to visit the community garden on a Sunday afternoon if people were going to be spending their time there. So I really learned the landscape of unaccompanied, undocumented youth workers in, you know, a certain set of neighborhoods in Los Angeles. I wouldn't even say Los Angeles as a whole, because I am a qualitative researcher, you know, limited to the spaces that I occupied. But I spent 6 years really learning how young people spend their time, why they go to the spaces that they go to. You know, it wasn't just by chance that they were at the community garden. There was something about being around plants and touching soil and really being feeling that they were in nature in a very urban setting of Pico Union, Los Angeles, that reminded them of home. So not just the spaces they occupied, but the utility of those spaces in their material and emotional lives, that really illuminated the sort of context of the very specific one-on-one interview conversations I was having. So with that, I would say my advice to people, especially graduate students that are entering these spaces or wanting to do work with unaccompanied youth or otherwise vulnerable populations, I would say dedicating time. And there's no time in the field that is unproductive. Those 7 months that I spent where I wasn't getting interviews despite my best efforts, it was not lost time. It was me showing to the young people in the field and in that group that I was observing that I was committed to the space and to learning. And even through my not so great Spanish that was at times embarrassing, that I was willing to show up in that space and be a part of the group. And those 7 months, I think, were foundational to my ability to spend the next 5.5 years doing this work. Mm.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive, America's number one motorcycle insurer. Everything is more exhilarating when you're on your motorcycle, just like your bike is more protected when you choose Progressive Motorcycle Insurance. They offer coverage for your bike starting as low as $75 per year, and they keep things affordable with discounts like paid in full, multi-policy, and responsible driver. So raise your kickstands and get to quoting at Progressive.com to see if you could save. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. $75 premium is for state minimum coverage. Not available in D.C. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Introducing our biggest GMC Acadia ever, offering bigger screens, bigger views, and even bigger journeys. Live your biggest life in the all-new GMC Acadia.
Thank you for explaining that. The process of research, I think, is both really interesting intellectually, but also really practical and helpful to understand, because so much of this is new to so many researchers. And being able to hear about what someone else has done is really quite helpful in thinking about how that might apply to other projects. But of course, we're here to focus on your project. So after all of that work to get people's trust and get people to talk to you and obviously then engage them for such a sustained period of time, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the decision to migrate in the first place that are being made by these youths and their families. And you talk particularly in the book about the imagined futures that are being drawn on to make, you know, quite a big decision. What is it that these families and youths are thinking could happen to them if they go to the US? And how does this influence kind of what they expect to have happen and what things they do to make this happen once they arrive?
Yeah, imagined futures is an important sort of thread throughout the book. We know that, and we talk about it in everyday life, right? About how immigrants leave their origin countries, leave their communities and families because they want a better life. We say a better life. There's embedded in that is a sort of notion of an imagined future, that the place they are going to will provide that better life in an imagined future. What I sort of parallel again is the status and condition of being an immigrant with the status and condition of being an adolescent transitioning into young adulthood. It is a life stage in which we are also imagining our futures. We often imagine our futures in protected institutional contexts, a parent-led household, or at least a caregiver-led household in K through 12 schools. Maybe we have clubs or groups that we're a part of. You know, I grew up in church. There was a sort of an imagined religious future also, right? Like there are reflections or refractions in our growing up experiences that sort of imply the life we will have moving forward. So I think about what it means to be an immigrant, a displaced person that is imagining a better life alongside an adolescent that is imagining their own future. What I talk about in the book is that when young people make decisions to migrate, if they are embedded in household familial context, the future that they imagined is not only an experience for themselves as adolescents coming of age, the life that they want to have either as a homeowner, a business owner, an educated individual, or someone that just experiences safety, right? As not being hungry, as not suffering. They imagine that future individually for themselves, but if they are embedded in household familial context, they imagine a collective future. And that is important because in the sort of migration or sociological literature, social science literature more broadly, we think about sort of migration as a rite of passage. We've talked about migration as the point at which young people transition into adulthood or autonomy, right? It is one of those markers of adulthood and success that are pointed to. So it's important to think about young people's individual and collective imagined futures because it points to the idea that migration can be a mechanism by which young people sort of become more connected to or embedded in their family unit, not necessarily autonomized from it, right? So that is really important to thinking about later in the book, why young people continue to endure the violence and exploitation and poverty and suffering in the U.S. that they do. And it is attached to this idea connected to the original motivation, right? Referred to as metas, the goals that young people set when they're leaving their origin countries. There's another sort of story that I tell where there is a familial disruption, either by violence outside of or within the home. I talk about one young person whose family were, I don't even, you know, trigger warning it. Family was shot in front of him at a very young age, and that he was left without any caregiver, and he became the caregiver of a younger brother that was received the sympathy of a neighbor. And this young person at 8 or 9 years old was now living alone in their origin country. The imagined future in that case is then very much individual. Or another young person who experienced domestic violence in the home, and there was no collective orientation in that migration decision. The imagined future again was individual. But there are these ideas that young people have about what life in the U.S. would promise them, not only as immigrants that are displaced from their origin countries, but as adolescents who are looking toward what it would mean to be a safe and stable and successful adult. And sometimes, like I said, that's attached to familial success, and sometimes that can be sort of the personal narrative of the self.
And if we're talking then about these incredibly important social contexts and ties that shape these sorts of imagined futures and also kind of the decisions made around them, that's not something that stops once the unaccompanied youth ends up in the US. To what extent did you find that households, perhaps through kinship networks, for example, were accepting of these unaccompanied migrants when they come? And what sorts of factors did you find determined the amount to which there was acceptance and kind of building into these social networks in a new place?
Yeah, There are cases in the book where young people were the first in their families to migrate. So they didn't have anyone in the U.S. that they could rely on. But for the most part, the people that I spent my time with in those 6 years did have someone in the U.S. that either they knew were living in the U.S. and thought that they would rely on them upon arrival, or the person that I refer to them as long settled relatives, right? These long settled relatives could have been involved in putting money together or connecting young people to a migration guide, a coyote, right? That would bring them across the U.S.-Mexico border and along the migration journey. What I find is that there are conditions that sort of have determined the receptivity of a long-settled relative of an unaccompanied minor long before the child has arrived. So in many cases, long-settled relatives are undocumented themselves and experiencing precarious legal status. They might have long experienced their own labor exploitation that keeps them living in poverty. They might have been in the U.S. so long that they started their own families and now have U.S.-born children. So the arrival of an unaccompanied child to their doorstep, in many cases, as benevolent or altruistic as the long-settled relative may feel or want to offer support, they are in a material condition where they cannot afford having a child in their household, having an additional mouth to feed, or if they know that they can't provide financial support and that the child will have to work in the U.S. to offset the cost of their living in that household, that would then put the U.S.-born child at risk, right? Say that the long-settled relative is discovered to have a child worker in their home, there's the risk of family separation through deportation of that undocumented long-settled relative. And that is the case of one young person, Tomas, who I open the chapter entitled Arrivals with. His older sister had been living in Los Angeles for several years, had a U.S.-born child, and the sister was initially welcoming of Tomas, and a few weeks went by and suddenly there was doubt and fear that maybe having Tomas, who would have to work in a garment factory in downtown LA to offset the cost of his arrival and living in that household, might then put the U.S.-born child at risk. So Tomas was left to just fend for himself, there was that sort of betrayal that he felt from his older sister because she initially took him in and then told him he had to leave the household. What I find is that the gender and age of the unaccompanied child sets the tone for how they are received and the type of and amount of support that they get. And the gender and age of the child is paired with the marriage status, the legal status, the socioeconomic status of the long-settled relative. So some general patterns that I can sort of point to now are that young men, unaccompanied boys, were typically perceived as being materially independent, or at least needing to be materially independent, right? This idea that masculinity is financial independence and adventure and taking care of yourself and those sorts of features meant that when a long-settled relative was also a man, there was the assumption that the young boy would take care of themselves because men are independent, you know? And then the opposite side of that is that if a long-settled relative was a woman, the sort of nurturing role, the expectation that women are caregivers and they take care of children and are sacrificial on behalf of their family members kicked in. And there were attempts to provide different forms of material and emotional support for an unaccompanied boy when they arrived. Because girls are perceived as being dependent and emotionally and materially vulnerable and just being, you know, emotional creatures that need to be protected, that initially benefited young girls in that long-settled relatives who were men and women tried to offer some forms of support. But the young girls sexuality often became a question if the long-settled relative was partnered, if there was an older woman living in the house. I have some cases where older women living in the house maybe became suspicious of the young girl, and whether or not her intentions or her male partner's intentions were good. And young girls became sexualized in ways that harmed their long-term relationship to the long-settled relative. So what I sort of leave off in chapter two, the chapter on arrivals, is that there are cases in which young people have long-settled relatives living in the U.S., but they can remain unaccompanied still. And this is a byproduct of these sort of power hierarchies, gender, sexuality, or the structural constraints of legal status and socioeconomic status that are imposed on a household where even if, again, a long-settled relative has the best intentions, there are ways that family ties fall apart, making it so that young people not only migrate unaccompanied, which is a traumatizing experience, right, but that they stay unaccompanied in their settlement in the U.S. over the longer term.
So let's then combine some of these different ideas that you've told us about and start to think about kind of what this means for the coming of age part of the subtitle of the book. If there are these precarious social situations that the young people are coming into and experiencing, combined with then, as you said earlier, the need to earn a wage, but also because of their age, because of the undocumented status, of course, this is low income work. How then does this kind of come together and influence what these youths think it means to be an adult, right? How does this influence ideas of not just what one eventually could be as an adult, but how one becomes that sort of thing, what that process is meant to look like?
Yeah, that's a really important question. And it's what I spend the rest of the book doing, really trying to explore, like, what does this sort of disruption that I explain in chapter one, the displacement of migration paired with the disruption of not having a place to land as young people thought they would, right? These are two things that are coming up against the imagined future, right? Young people imagined futures where they would either spend just a few years working in the U.S. and they would go back home, or that they would arrive in the U.S., get support, and they could spend time in school, that they would spend time as students, that they would have a career, that they would live a different life other than the sort of poverty and suffering and low-wage work that they were experiencing in their origin countries. What the unaccompanied migration and unaccompanied settlement after arrival does to young people, I explain in the next chapter entitled Disorientations, is disorient them, right? So they come into U.S. society and they are disoriented by what it means to be unaccompanied. The realization that kids in the U.S. don't work in the way that kids in their origin country did, right? That everything is sort of hyper-commodified, that it is expensive to live in the U.S. and that their wages are no match for the cost of living, that they are alone and isolated in a lot of ways and in community, and they will have to learn the bus routes or what streets are safe for them to cross in order to get to the local church or the group that meets down the street. There are multiple ways in which young people come to experience disorientation, and adding the feeling of betrayal from long settled relatives is an emotional disorientation that they encounter. Over time, I describe a process by which young people learn their society. They become oriented to not only the structure of U.S. society, but they become oriented to their local neighborhood and community. They become oriented to social ties, and which ties, which spaces, which resources would allow them to move closer to their imagined future. I lay out then two potential pathways where young people can either become adapted to society, right? They develop meaningful social ties, and maybe they don't achieve high rates of mobility in the way that incorporation theory would then track successful incorporation, but they achieve stability, the feeling that they have become adjusted, they understand what's happening, and they can make inroads to their education or their wage mobility or to supporting their family and finishing the house that they promised their mom they would build or something like that, right? Like some progress toward the imagined future. There are other young people, though, that do not develop the meaningful social ties, that remain isolated, that continue to materially and emotionally struggle. And they experience what they refer to, my participants refer to as perdición, which is translated as perdition, but as most translations, it doesn't really capture the full depth of what perdición means, the sort of loss of self, the loss of the future, the loss of emotional connection and hopefulness. Young people refer to the U.S. in these cases as un lugar de perdición, a place of perdition, where they and their futures and their family fates become lost in the inequality, the lack of resources and opportunities, the isolation and the angst and depression and distress that isolation causes. So when young people think about then what it means to be an adult, what it means to be successful as an immigrant and as an adult, or an adult immigrant, let's say, what they talk about is their ability to traverse those emotional and material disorientations into a state of orientation and adaptation. So I try in the book, and readers will have to tell me whether I capture this process well, I try to explain incorporation as just an ongoing process where young people feel disoriented to whatever the immediate institution or neighborhood or relationship may be. And then they become oriented, and then they feel like, okay, I got a hang of this. They have adapted or adjusted. And that gives them the sort of strength, courage, resources to try something new, right? When young people feel like they've got a hang of work, they might enroll in school. If they got a hang of the English language, they might then move out of the Pico Union neighborhood where they only traverse maybe a few blocks to across town to a beach town where it's not predominantly Spanish-speaking Latino immigrants, right? But English-speaking, wealthier, typically white, U.S. born people. So I try to explain this process in the book, or I will claim it. I explain the process in this book where young people are constantly engaged in this process of disorientation, orientation, and adaptation. And in that, success is the material stability that they acquire, but also the emotional stability and maturation. If young people can say, I was really depressed, I had no friends, I was hungry, I didn't know how to ride the bus in the first 3, 4, 5 years of their arrival, and I'm talking to them 8, 9, or 10 years later, and they tell me, not only do I know these things for myself, but I am now mentoring young people, more recently arrived immigrants, or more recently arrived adult immigrants in that process from disorientation to orientation to adaptation, that becomes the marker of success.
So that's obviously a very interesting kind of, I suppose, trajectory or development of what success and adulthood can look like. And in these circumstances that we've been talking about, where those imagined futures at the beginning have gone through and had to go through rather a lot of changes. And one aspect of that, of course, is the need to work and rather than go to school. In the book, you call this work primacy. Can you tell us a bit more about this and how it impacts different immigrants differently?
Yeah, the concept of work primacy is really central to my analysis of young people's coming of age as workers. And what it sort of introduces into our understanding of immigrant youth incorporation is that we have largely understood incorporation as occurring in, as I mentioned, protected institutions, parent-led households, and K through 12 schools. What we haven't called that is school primacy, right? That we have developed decades of understanding of youth's coming of age in the U.S. under the assumption that they're growing up in schools, that this is where they learn the language and the culture. So when thinking back to that original sort of motivation to get into this research, I was organizing with undocumented students. And why didn't that trajectory of coming of age really make sense for the youth workers that I was now researching? And that was because their growing up was not in K through 12 schools. There was no argument to be made about being American in every way except for their legal status. My participants were growing up as we know undocumented adult workers live, that they are experiencing labor exploitation, that they are having to sacrifice their bodies and their health and their well-being. And for these young people, again, in their transition to adulthood, their self-concept for the sake of survival in the absence of legal status that would protect them from such abuse and in the absence of parents who would do that sacrificial work on their behalf. So work primacy captures then not only that young people who are unaccompanied, undocumented youth workers, that the primary institution in which they spend their everyday lives, their waking hours, is the workplace, but that even when they're outside of work, they're making decisions about how to enroll in school, how to spend their time, whether or not to establish romantic relationships, whether or not they'll eat that cheeseburger at McDonald's, right? From the position of an independent, unaccompanied youth worker. So the trying to capture really that work is the primary space and worker is the primary role that defines the incorporation and coming of age of unaccompanied undocumented youth workers. In terms of what differences I found, what I came to understand is that women experience the intensity of work primacy more than men in some cases because of the types of jobs that women are constrained to and because of the expectation that women will spend non-work hours in the private sphere, in the home. So women are more likely to be domestic workers, to be homemakers, to be nannies, or if they're working in more public spaces, the restaurants or the factories where men are, that they wouldn't be sort of developing relationships, developing networks with men because that is not what women do, right? And that they could be shamed for being out at night or that they could be shamed for occupying public spaces where men typically are. So women were more constrained to households in the private sphere, which meant that work was really the only place where they would establish relationships or gain any sort of insight and knowledge about the community or how to become oriented and adapted to their society. And then, of course, I have a set of interviews that I conducted with Indigenous unaccompanied migrant youth, reflecting the starting point of the research with that support group in 2012. And Indigenous young people experience not only anti-immigrant sentiment and anti-Latino sentiment on a sort of broad societal level, but they also experience anti-Indigenous sentiment, anti-Indigenous racism within the Latino community. So when we're talking about low-wage work, Indigenous young people were typically being assigned the most tedious tasks, the most painful and low-paying tasks. So even in a factory where we imagine all people are being exploited, Indigenous young people were being assigned the piece rate job of sewing a button, 3 cents per button, as opposed to the denim zipper that gets 15 cents per zipper, right? So there's even a hierarchy within these exploitative and harmful jobs that young people were doing where Indigenous youth were experiencing some of the most horrific violations of their labor. And then in that also being ridiculed for being Indigenous, ridiculed for their Indigenous language that they spoke by non-Indigenous Latinos. So there was a sort of hierarchical or nested effect of their ethno-racial identity as Mayan indigenous youth.
ABC Wednesday. It's the premiere everyone is talking about.
I'm Joan, and I'm your first Golden Bachelorette.
Loves getting a second chance.
When you're 61 years old, you have very few opportunities to change your life. I have to be ready.
The Golden Bachelorette is proving romance never ages.
I represent millions of people in their golden years looking for love.
The Golden Bachelorette.
I am ready to find the next great love of my life.
Series premiere Wednesday on ABC and stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Opill, the first over-the-counter daily birth control pill available in the U.S. Opill is FDA approved, full prescription strength, and estrogen free. Plus, there's no prescription needed. Finally, the days of needing a prescription for birth control are over. Opill is available online and at most major retailers. Take control of your health and reproductive journey with Opill. Birth control in your control. Use code BIRTHCONTROL for 25% off your first month of Opill at opill.com.
And that idea of gendered and other differences in these experiences isn't just in this area of work primacy. You also talk about it in the book in terms of emotions and emotional expression. Can you talk about that in terms of especially what we were discussing earlier around disorientation?
Yeah. So because of these gendered expectations of where young people will spend their time or how they will even express themselves in moments of distress, there were constraints on the way participants would cope with the material and emotional disorientation or even the long-term sort of perdition that they were experiencing, right? What I describe in the book is that women often, because of the expectation that they would occupy the private sphere, women often relied on private relationships, typically romantic relationships, to soothe the loneliness or to maybe even mitigate the financial precarity that they were in, right? Establishing relationships to accumulate income or to feel a sense of material stability and being able to more securely pay rent every month, right? They would also rely on men or relationships more broadly for companionship because, again, there were constraints on their ability to join the support group that I was observing Friday nights from 7 to 9 p.m., right? This idea that women should be home at that time meant that there was mostly men occupying those spaces, or the Saturday night youth group that went until 10 p.m., even at the church, that women would be home earlier than that. So they really retreated to private romantic relationships, which meant that they could become isolated emotionally and materially. There's a case that I describe in the book about a young woman who met a man in a factory who promised her that he would take care of her and provide for her and her family that still lived in Guatemala. And what ended up happening is that she became socially isolated, she became financially dependent, she lost ties to her family in Guatemala out of shame of the domestic abuse that she was experiencing in Los Angeles, and also she became financially dependent on this man, so she wasn't able to send her own economic resources to support her left-behind family. Well, what I also found is that men, they experienced the same emotional distress. It was the same angst and loneliness and fear of exploitation and fear of the future by virtue of being unaccompanied and undocumented. But again, the gendered expectation that men are not emotionally expressive, and this idea that men's space are places in the public sphere, meant that they relied on the young boys and teenagers that I interviewed. They relied on the public sphere to soothe the loneliness. So that meant that they would start hanging out with the older men that were on the front stoop of their apartment complex that were maybe drinking, you know, the ways that adult men were coping with their loneliness and their financial, legal, familial precarity was by trying to sort of drown the pain. And I talk about cases where young people, young men specifically, turned to drugs and alcohol to quiet the pain that they were experiencing. And that there are cases across both groups that young people had, you know, suicidal ideation, dealt with suicidal ideation, or dealt with self-harm, again, as a way to cope with their emotional distress of being unaccompanied and undocumented, of experiencing high levels of poverty and feeling a sense of deep loneliness. And that sort of led me to an analysis of the importance of meaningful social ties, the importance of having a space of, I call it desahogo. Young people called it desahogo, which translates to unburdening, venting maybe, but really ahogar in Spanish is to drown. So I thought about desahogo as undrowning, the sort of undrowning from the overwhelming emotional pain of being an unaccompanied, undocumented youth worker. And that if we can create spaces of desahogo, of undrowning for young people, they might not then rely on the drugs and alcohol or fall into abusive romantic relationships or enact self-harm as a coping mechanism for the pain that they experience.
So is it then not drowning? Is it then not being in these feelings of perdition? Is that what your participants conceptualized as success?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And, you know, I talk about in the book that I wasn't able to interview people who are in the throes of perdición, right? I wasn't going to get someone to sit down with me and explain to me their drug or alcohol addiction, or, you know, that there's that side of qualitative research where people typically kind of like social media. You catch them at their highs and they're willing to tell you the successes. So I conceptualized perdición based on the experiences, sort of second or third hand stories I heard of young people who were experiencing perdición. But also I talked to several young people who had identified that they had previously been in a state of perdición, but because they developed meaningful relationships, they were able to become reoriented and then experienced adaptation. So when young people think about success in the U.S., it can be the occupational mobility. It can be that they graduated from their English language class, or again, that they built the home or started the business in their origin country as they set out to when they initially migrated. But it can also be that they came out of perdición, that they are no longer reliant on drugs or alcohol to soothe their loneliness. And not only that, but that when they notice other people in their community are struggling with those things, that they can become mentors, right? That they have developed a toolkit enough that they can usher other people through that process of reorientation and adaptation and out of a state of perdition. So success is not only a socioeconomic endpoint or the sort of traditional markers of a transition to adulthood, you do step 1, 2, 3, but it is an ongoing emotional process of healing, of desahogo, of the discovery and the grounding of the self.
So what can be done to improve these situations, to create more environments in which perdition maybe doesn't have as much of an impact, or more support is available to help people come out of it, or looking at this more broadly? What have you come across in terms of, or what do you think could be done to improve these contexts that unaccompanied, undocumented youths find themselves in?
Yeah, I outline several potential pathways of intervening in the lives of young people like those that I interviewed and spent time with in this book. Beginning with, again, that point of departure, the imagined future. If we understand that young people have ideas about how they want to live their lives at very young ages, can we create an intervention where we are sort of on the ground trying to understand the futures youth imagine in the origin countries, in the origin communities that kids are migrating from? So that doesn't mean investing in large corporations, private corporations that will then go into these communities, displace markets and industries, and hire people for work. It means really going into the communities and spending time with community organizations that are working on youth development, youth integration on the ground, and asking, you know, what is it that kids in this community need in order to achieve their imagined future? Maybe that'll slow migration. Maybe that'll cut the number in half or even by a little bit, right? But I think an intervention needs to start at the point of departure, because many young people, as I mentioned, they imagined that they would be in the U.S. for maybe 3 or 5 years at most. They didn't think they would be 35 years old, you know, in Los Angeles, still having left at the age of 14. So I think recognizing that if it were up to many of the migrant youth that are leaving their homes today, they wouldn't leave at all. And that is one point. Following the story of the book, I also think that we should support the legalization of unaccompanied young people, provide some kind of protected legal status. I argue for recognizing these young people as refugees, and I explain the sort of history of displacement and U.S. intervention in Central America and Mexico that has caused the rates of migration and the patterns of migration we've seen over the last several decades, including the recent rise of unaccompanied children to the U.S. So recognizing that we have, the U.S. has been active in the displacement of these young people for decades, right? Not even in starting in 2013 when my participants were migrating, but as far back as the 1950s and 60s is important. So recognizing the need to provide legal protection for them. And if we don't want to do that, because they are recently arrived, we should support the long settled relatives who've been in the U.S. for 10, 15, 20 years, because maybe a lot of these young people would not have been youth workers had the long settled relative been in a position to support them materially and emotionally upon their arrival. Beyond that, things like providing young people with work permits or deferred action, some protection from deportation that would enable them to report violations of their labor rights, and for them to be able to advocate for their rightful wages and recognition of the hours they work. And that isn't just for unaccompanied youth. This is U.S.-born and other immigrant workers in the U.S. who are having their labor rights violated every single day within a lot of these industries and others. So attention to the rights of workers is essential. And then I think broadly, I would hope that one of the takeaways of this book is that we need to listen to young people. We need to listen to what they need, what would make them feel supported. And in the case of my participants, right, I did this research between 2012 and 2018. I interviewed people when they were in their early 20s. By now, we're all in our 30s, right? These are now long settled immigrants in the way that their relatives were upon their arrival. So can we call on the expertise? Can we call on the knowledge of long settled unaccompanied youth who are now adults and ask what would have made a difference in your life? And I think the book would suggest that meaningful social ties, opportunities for connection in local communities, you know, the ability to desahogar, right, to overcome, to vent from the trauma and the pain of being unaccompanied and undocumented young people, maybe is not the only solution, but should be considered as a part of the solution, because the emotional side of an immigrant's incorporation or coming of age is important in how they deal with the material hardship, right, the decisions they make, the way they sort of approach their everyday lives. And I hope those things come through in readers' engagement with Sin Padres Ni Papeles.
That's a very helpful answer to that question, and also a great way to round off our discussion about the book. Thank you very much for that. I do, however, have one last question, which always feels a bit odd asking someone whose book is so recently out. But it is out in the world. People can go read the book and get all the details that we weren't able to cover here. So what might you be working on now that it's done?
Yeah, I am really excited to say that I have a book coming out in the summer of 2025 that focuses just on the experiences of the 36 Indigenous young people that are included in this book. One of the things that was really hard in writing Sin Padres Sin Papeles is trying to capture all of the nuance, right? And one of the most important nuances and complexities really of the unaccompanied, undocumented youth worker experience, as we touched on earlier, is that Indigenous youth, because of that sort of nested incorporation experience that they face, the anti-Indigenous sentiment within the Latino community that stratifies their experiences there even before they start to interact with the U.S. Los Angeles mainstream or U.S. mainstream broadly, it was really important for me to be able to elaborate on how ethno-racial identity, Indigenous Mayan languages, and young people's encounters with that anti-Indigenous racism and stratification shapes the way they experience incorporation and coming of age. So I'm working on this book with a linguistic anthropologist, Brendan O'Connor, at Arizona State University, that really gets into how Indigenous unaccompanied youth encounter all of the systems and hierarchies and everyday interactions that I uncover in Sin Padres Ni Papeles. So if people are interested in this book, I would say the next one, it's tentatively entitled Everyday Futures, that it must be engaged with sort of in tandem with Sin Padres. So I appreciate so much that people are interested in this work. And I'm also grateful for the chance to elaborate on the lives of unaccompanied undocumented youth workers in Los Angeles.
Well, that's very exciting to hear about. So best of luck with that, in some ways, sequel project, I suppose. And I'm sure we'll all be curious to hear more about it. But of course, in the meantime, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, Sin Padres Ni Papeles, Unaccompanied Migrant Youth Coming of Age in the United States, published by the University of California Press in 2024. Stephanie, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me. I've had a great time.